It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a meteorologist will give his forecast for this year's tornado season in Wisconsin.
Right now, we're kicking off a three-part Wisconsin Public Radio news series. In his 2010 campaign for governor, Scott Walker made a brown bag promise to voters to run government more like the way they run their own lives. And while he spoke in general terms, Walker did include enough specifics so that 4 years later, it's possible to take a look at how he did. In the first of a three-part series on Walker's promises by the numbers, Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson has this report.
Given all that's happened in Wisconsin politics over the past 4 years, it's easy to forget that there was a time when Scott Walker talked about his brown bag promise on a near daily basis. He featured it in his TV ads.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. I pack a brown bag lunch so I can afford to pay for other things, like Wisconsin's high taxes.
He talked about it in his stump speech, including at the 2010 state Republican convention.
It's based on three simple principles. First, my grandmother would love this. Don't spend more money than you have. Secondly, smaller government is better government. And third, most importantly, people create jobs, not the government.
4 years later, on a sunny Saturday at the Dane County Farmers Market, the brown bag promise is far from people's minds.
The brown bag. No, can't say that. No. I remember.
I don't remember that term. No, the brown bag promise. I don't recall that. No.
The brown bag promise. No, it doesn't. Sorry.
Vaguely.
That was Kurt Stelflew, Jeff Bybee, Carl Harder, and Jen Engel. And while they had mixed reactions to Walker's promise once they heard it, they did agree on one thing. It's a bit vague, and pieces of it are hard to pin down. But you can measure the first part of the promise. Don't spend more than you have. Walker lived up to that in his first budget, says Todd Berry with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance.
You'd have to say so. I mean, that first budget was very austere. I don't think anybody who lived through that period would say it wasn't a pretty tough time.
Simply put, Walker's first two-year budget cut state government's general fund until what it spent was less than what it had. But Berry says Walker's second budget is headed in a different direction, starting with next fiscal year.
We're going to spend, it looks like, more than we're going to bring in revenue. And the reason simply is we have some big tax cuts.
The nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau projects that in year two of this budget, the state will spend $559 million more than it takes in. And that's just the general fund. To really dig into this promise, you have to look at the transportation budget. Road construction continues throughout Wisconsin this summer, even though state government faces some serious issues when it comes to paying for it. The state borrows to pay for construction projects, sort of like most people use mortgages to pay for houses. The trouble in Wisconsin is that borrowing keeps going up, with no end in sight. John Peacock directs the budget project at the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
At a time when the economy was doing well and coming out of a recession, that's the perfect time to reduce the amount of bonding, but instead we've increased it.
It's not that people don't know how to fix this, but Walker has shot down proposals to raise taxes or fees to pay for roads. At the same time, his budgets are spending more. Walker did not create this problem, but he is making it worse. The Fiscal Bureau says total state indebtedness is projected to grow by more than $1 billion under the governor's watch. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow in this series, Sean will take a look at Governor Walker's campaign promise that smaller government is better government.
We turn now for perspective on Governor Walker's budget promises to John Peacock. We just heard him briefly in that story. John Peacock is research director at the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, where he directs their state budget project. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's talk about how debt and deficits work in Wisconsin. We can't run a deficit like the federal government does. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So how do we handle, we can still have debt though, so it's a little different thing. How does debt work in the terms of our state budget?
Well, the state can issue bonds for major projects like transportation projects and that kind of thing. And the state's been doing a lot of that. And as the piece indicated, bonding is increasing or has increased since the year before Governor Walker took office by $1.2 billion, and it's going up by another $300 million in 2015.
Where are we seeing spending going up to generate the need for those bonds? Is it mainly transportation?
Well, that's part of it also. And we still, even with that additional bonding for transportation, we still have a significant hole that we're going to have to deal with there in the transportation budget in the next session. But in addition to that, the governor's first budget refinanced a lot of bonds, and it didn't refinance them in the way that we think of it with respect to our home mortgages. What it did is essentially restructured them so that we didn't make payments in the short term and had bigger payments off in future years.
So it allows us to make that budget happen this year without a deficit, but maybe leaves a problem 2, 4, 6 years down the road.
Yeah, exactly.
And is that what we're talking about? We've heard the phrase structural deficit in Wisconsin for, I'll say, at least 20 years. Is that what we mean when we say structural deficit?
Yeah, different states have different ways of measuring what are called structural deficits, and ours is a bit unusual, but how we measure it could be a topic for a long discussion another day. In brief, though, a structural deficit is a measure of potential red ink in the next biennial budget. It's a mismatch between what the current revenues look like and the current expenditures look like. Sean's piece mentioned that in the second year of this biennium, state general fund spending will exceed the general fund tax revenue by $560 million. We're able to do that because we carried over surplus money. But when we spend down that surplus money, then you're setting yourself up for a structural deficit in the next biennium. And so, you know, and some people point out, well, we can grow our way out of that. You know, the structural deficit calculation doesn't take into account potential future revenue increases. And that's true. But it also doesn't take into account potential future spending increases. And so to say that we're just going to grow our way out of it, you have to assume that revenue growth is going to exceed your increased needs. And that often isn't a very good assumption to make.
Well, let's stay on that revenue side. Times were tough. Tax revenues were down through the Great Recession. We are in a slow but apparently real recovery. Doesn't it make sense to anticipate some kind of revenue growth as the economy improves?
Sure, it does. And there's been revenue growth in the last couple of years. And as we realized that revenue growth and as it came in greater than expectations for a while, the legislatures did what they oftentimes do going into an election year. They promised a lot. They used that surplus in this instance for pretty substantial tax cuts, and as we saw back when Lee Dreyfus did that 30 years ago, as we saw when Tommy Thompson did that 20 years ago, and Democrats have done as well, that going into an election year they oftentimes give back surpluses in ways that are unsustainable. And that's starting to look like it may be a problem because the latest revenue collection figures are starting to look pretty soft. And we could really be in for a challenge in the coming fiscal year and the next biennium.
Well, there's been a long history of this, as you say, Republicans using surplus for tax cuts, Democrats using it for increased spending. I believe when you had Tommy Thompson, Republican governor and Democratic state legislature, they had a deal to do both at the same time. And there's been an ongoing criticism saying, let's use some of that surplus for a rainy day fund to balance out, say, a big recession that might be around the corner. Have we started to try to do that?
Wisconsin's been near the very bottom for decades in terms of setting aside money for a rainy day. We finally started making progress in recent years, and I give legislators credit for that, and especially last year and the year before, they did build up the rainy day fund. It's far below where it needs to be, but it started growing. But then this year, as revenue came in greater than anticipated, they suspended the state statute that required half of that unanticipated revenue growth to go into the rainy day fund. They wanted to provide larger tax cuts, and so that statutory requirement was inconvenient, and so it was temporarily suspended.
We're talking with John Peacock. He's research director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. We're talking about the state's budget and Governor Walker's scorecard on making good on his 2010 budget commitments.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. How do you score Governor Walker's performance on the budget promises he made in 2010? How have budget policies affected the state of Wisconsin or affected you personally? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also chime in on our Facebook page.
We continue our discussion now about budget promises made by Governor Scott Walker in his election campaign in 2010 and what degree he's been able to realize them. John Peacock stays with us. He's research director at the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families and director of the State Budget Project.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. How do you see Governor Walker's budget policies playing out in the state? Do you think he's made good on those promises he made back in 2010? How have they affected you and your community? You can join in our discussion at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org.
And we heard in our piece from Sean Johnson earlier what Governor Walker said in his brown bag promise was, don't spend more than you have when you're a state government. John, there are different schools of thought about that. Some economists, some in politics say in times of economic downturn, do spend more than you have, borrow to do it, to stimulate the economy, to meet the needs of social services. It may sound like common sense, don't spend more than you have. Is it more complex than that?
Well, it is more complex, and certainly during the recession, that was a very hotly debated issue and at the federal level, it continues to be an issue of some debate in terms of how strong is the economy now and at what point should we start pulling back in terms of federal investments that help or that could help the economy grow faster. But here at the state level, now that we're in what's supposed to be about the fourth, fifth year of the admittedly slow recovery, this is really the time when we need to be socking away as much money as we can, putting it into reserves so that when we face that next downturn or when we have more tornadoes that were a lot more serious than these ones the other day, that we're ready for that rainy day.
And do we miss opportunities to make key investments in the state if we're focused too much, if that's possible, on a balanced budget?
Sure. I think that there is that risk, but we do have the obligation at the state level to balance the budget. I think it's one of the reasons why we want to build up the rainy day fund when we can, is that then when we're in much slower periods of economic growth or decline than we're facing right now, that then we can dip into that and even things out.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Casey on the line in Madison. Casey, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, so I just think that some of the policies, specifically Act 10 and balancing the budget on sort of the school and public worker sectors, is short-sighted in terms of the desire for long-term job creation and the education that's required to do higher-skill jobs. It seems ironic to me that we would say we need more jobs in the state, but then spend less money on education.
Casey, thanks a lot for the call. So Act 10, part of Governor Walker's fiscal policies, he said needed to limit union bargaining power in order to save money at the local level and at the state level. How did that fit into this discussion, John?
Well, it it's complicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, there's just the whole debate about the merits of the way that the governor balanced the last budget. And I think it's a different discussion than we're having today. But for whatever it's worth, I tend to agree with Casey that the kinds of cuts that we made, I think, are cuts that have hurt the state economy by taking money out of the pockets of low-income families, cutting the earned income tax credit, taking money out of the pockets of public sector workers. I think that's been one of the things that slowed down our economic growth. But you know, people can argue different sides of that. I think on what those cuts did do, the very austere budget in Act 10, as Todd Berry pointed out, whether you liked it or not, it did eliminate the structural deficit. But now this session, we've seen backsliding because the legislators who professed that it was so important to get the budget back into the black then got preoccupied with larger tax cuts this session. And so they've recreated a structural deficit.
But how does that structural deficit compare, say, to the deficits in the late 90s?
We've seen considerably larger structural deficits in many other years. So relatively speaking, where this one stands right now, based on the latest calculations, isn't too terribly worrisome. On the other hand, as we look at the revenue collections in recent months, and now over the first 10 months of the current fiscal year, revenue is actually below where it was in the previous fiscal year. That was not anticipated. If it turns out that was the effect of something more than just a temporary blip, the polar vortex or whatever, if that becomes a longer trend, both for this fiscal year and the next fiscal year, we could be back where we have a pretty serious structural deficit again.
What kind of changes would you like to see in the legislature and from the governor, whoever that might be, next year, to try to rein in a potential structural deficit?
Well, I'd like to see us, for one, to honor the commitment made in the statutes that when we do have additional revenue growth, that we use that to beef up the rainy day fund. At least when the economy is strong, we ought to be doing that. I think we also there's a statute on the books that Governor Walker has postponed by 4 years that would require the state to put more into the general fund balance, that a cushion that you have at the end of each fiscal year in case revenue turns down that you can use without even tapping into the rainy day fund. That requirement was enacted about 20 years ago, and each governor and legislature keeps postponing the day that we build that up to a reasonable balance. And then third, I think we need better ways of actually calculating the structural deficit. I think we ought to look to Minnesota, where they look out 4 years as they do their fiscal planning. We just look out a couple years, and that results in a lot of game playing in terms of maneuvers that are made to push obligations off beyond the next biennium so they don't show up in the structural deficit calculations.
This sounds like yet another story where maybe short-term political considerations are trumping long-term fiscal decision-making.
Well, that's exactly it. And it's a long-standing problem that both parties have engaged in a very nonpartisan way.
Is there a way around that? I mean, you mentioned the Minnesota concept where you calculate out 4 years, so that would at least limit the extent to which politicians could push this down the road and have the bad numbers be beyond the horizon.
Yeah, I think that would help a lot to just have just a general set of principles that we put in place. Now, you can do that and still have the legislature suspend them as they did this year with the requirement to beef up the rainy day fund. But I think over time you can get to where Minnesota is, where there's just sort of just more value put on having black ink instead of red ink.
Is the budget and a potential deficit going to be an issue, do you think, in the politics this year with the election for governor and the legislature?
Well, if you look back to the last elections almost 2 years ago, the the majority party had eliminated the structural deficit. And whether you liked, whether you agreed with Casey and didn't like how they did it, or you did like Act 10, at least they did cut the structural deficit. I think they thought that they would be able to argue the same thing this year. But if the recent revenue trends keep getting worse, as it looks like it may be the case, that might be a liability for them this fall.
We'll leave it there for now. John, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's John Peacock. He's Research Director at the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly update from Congress, including today's meeting. President Obama talked to congressional leaders about the next steps in Iraq.
First, though, we're talking about some of the severe weather around Wisconsin this week. The National Weather Service says about six tornadoes touched down in Wisconsin late Monday and early Tuesday. They are the first tornadoes of the year.
And that's a late start to the tornado season in Wisconsin, the latest start since 1962. Usually runs from May to July, but 2014 had been pretty quiet so far. But it doesn't mean we're in for a mild tornado season, according to weather experts.
That's right. Chad Franzen is with us now. He is a meteorologist for WSAW-TV in Wausau. And Chad, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Well, we're doing pretty well. We're sort of drying out for the moment, as is a good chunk of the state, and it looks like we have some more to come. We typical tornado season in Wisconsin apparently runs from May to July. This year it's running a little bit late. When did the first tornado touch down in Wisconsin this year?
This year it was just this past 24 or 48 hours now that we had that very first one happen. And overall, you know, we had that long spring, or excuse me, a very short spring, but kind of a long winter.
Mm-hmm.
So things, the weather patterns are not very summer-like. They're just getting that way now, when typically in the past we've had this set up maybe at the last part of May. Now it seems like the weather patterns maybe 3 or 4 weeks behind. So while it was nice to be able to go such a long period into the season without a tornado, now we had some active weather, and it's going to be kind of on and off with the active storms here in the course of the next couple of days.
So let's talk a little bit about the weather conditions that lead to tornadoes. You mentioned that the sort of the absence of a spring, we had that long extended winter, was not helpful in helping tornadoes to come to Wisconsin. Why is that? And then to sort of flip that on its head, what are the weather conditions that are conducive to tornadoes?
Sure. You know, we get a delay in that weather pattern, that, and usually when we get into very strong to severe thunderstorms, we need a clash of the air masses, so to speak. Well, it took Wisconsin a long time to really kind of warm up and get into the warmer weather, so that's why we kind of saw a delayed start to the summer severe weather season, which, as you mentioned earlier, typically runs late May through the last part of July. This year, now it's kind of starting in the middle of June and probably will make it into the first part of August. And what we typically talk about as a meteorologist when you're looking at these severe storms is you need a clash of the air masses. You need a warm, humid air mass out ahead of a system, and usually some kind of a front or some kind of a triggering mechanism to trigger that warm, humid air mass to really blow up into these thunderstorms. Think of it as a pot of boiling water on the stove and the lid on it. Once you get that mechanism to pull that lid off, you see that rapid expanse of the gas into the air, and that's how these thunderstorms really develop. And we've been basically stuck along a boundary that's over Wisconsin, back through Nebraska and Iowa, and now we're just seeing repeated chances of these stronger storms, and case in point was the last couple of nights.
Yeah, it feels as though we're sort of stuck in a pattern over the last couple of days. Is that typically what happens, that you get into a pattern and then it takes a while for us to get out of it?
Well, usually when we get into a summer situation or summer severe weather situation, Wisconsin isn't known for these training events where they constantly, continually happen back to back to back. In the summertime, you usually get one or two days of these warm, humid situations, a couple of strong thunderstorms, and it's done. Here, this pattern set up on Sunday, and for the most part is going to be with us until we get around to the end of the week. So maybe in years past and summers past, a more typical summer strong storm, severe storm setup is a day or two, and it's done. This week has been pretty much all week long. We will have some stronger thunderstorms again, especially southwestern Wisconsin, late tonight and again for tomorrow night and even into Friday as well.
Now, as the season got off to a late start, I imagine a lot of people are hopeful that what that means is then that the season will be shorter or that we'll wind up having fewer tornadoes as part of the season. Is there any way you can predict the length of the season at this point?
Well, there's some speculation right now that an El Nino is going to set up later this summer into the wintertime. And El Ninos in Wisconsin are better known for typically milder winter times. What could happen is as this El Nino continues to kind of warm up, the abnormal waters of the Pacific Ocean warming up, as it sets up later in the summertime, our summer severe weather season may be pushed into maybe that first couple of weeks of August, when traditionally maybe it ends closer to the end of July. So the season overall could still be a 2 to 3 month season with chances for summer severe weather. But of course, when you're talking long-term patterns, certainly that could easily change. But my prognosis at this point is we'll probably have a pretty active pattern on and off through the rest of summer and even into the early part of August.
And in terms of numbers or the possibility of numbers of tornadoes, I imagine it's also a little too early right now to make that prediction that it's going to be a busy year or a not busy year for tornadoes.
Yes, correct. It is pretty early to be able to do that. On average, the most tornado-prone month in Wisconsin is usually July, and it's actually that late July, first week of August time frame, although June certainly does see a peak in tornadoes, just not as quite as large as that time frame. So my guess is we'll see more occurrences like this as we get into July, and we'll probably have a pretty typical summer severe weather season. And let's hope for the latter. Let's hope that we just don't get the tornadic storms again. But the season's just really kind of starting up across Wisconsin.
Now, in a typical year, how many tornadoes wind up touching down or being recorded in Wisconsin?
I'm looking at a 20-year average, the last 20 years in Wisconsin. And we're talking about 23 to 24 a year. And that's just the last 20 years. So you can apply it back a little farther than that. So we're talking about 24, and we've had 6 now in the last 48 hours. So theoretically, to get to that average, you'd have 18 more yet to come, not only in June, July, and probably even early August.
And here's a question I imagine a lot of people have. Is there any particular part of the state that is more prone to tornadoes than others, or is it really a tornado just an equal opportunity storm that can happen anywhere?
Yeah, pretty much an equal opportunity storm that can happen anywhere. The boundary that these very strong thunderstorms have developed upon happens to be sitting in southern Minnesota, southwestern, south-central Wisconsin. That's why the tornadic storms in the last couple of days have been along that boundary, along that line. In central northern Wisconsin, there have been some very strong thunderstorms, but because it's away from that boundary, they're not of a tornadic variety. They're more of a wind producer and some large hail and some heavy rainfall. Then you compound that into southern and southwestern Wisconsin and add in a tornadic effect. So that's why it's just been a little stronger there. But pretty much all of Wisconsin's been affected by some pretty strong storms here in the last 2 days.
It also seems to me that, remembering from weather reporting from when I was younger, that it's a lot better these days in terms of the ability to get some really up-to-date information about where a tornado is and whether it's developing and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just it is the biggest thing is being able to get the word out and get those warnings out. And the warning process for severe thunderstorms and tornado warnings has come a long ways in the last couple of years, especially in the last few years with a new Doppler radar type called dual polarization. It allows you to see a little better into the storm. So, the better you can get the word out, the better you can keep people safe. And, those are things that, unfortunately, in southern Wisconsin's case where we had those 6 tornadoes, it was a nighttime event where a lot of people had already gone to bed, and you're just hopeful that someone has a cell phone that can receive a tornado warning or some kind of weather radio or an app on their phones to help them notify that, because it was such a late night event.
Or in my case, I had a siren that was approximately 6 inches from my head. It woke me
up. That would be a good way to wake you up too as well.
Yeah, once I got off the ceiling, everything was fine. Well, Chad, thanks so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Enjoy your time. Thank you so much, and have a good afternoon.
Yeah, you too. Chad Franzen with us there, a meteorologist for WSAW-TV in Wausau.
It's time for a weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. As conflict continues to heat up in Iraq, President Obama spoke with leaders from both parties in Congress earlier this afternoon about what steps the United States might take in response.
And after last week's surprise primary loss by House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, the debate continues in the Republican Party over who should take his place.
Paul Singer joins us each week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Nice to be back. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Well, so far, so good.
All right. Well, President Obama meeting with leaders from both parties to talk about Iraq. What was the president bringing to the table at that meeting?
Well, in fact, it's still going on, or it may have just actually broken up. Basically, you know, the president has said pretty clearly he does not intend to put people on the ground, boots on the ground in Iraq again. The problem is, of course, without that, it's not clear what else we can do to support the Iraqi government in trying to fight off these insurgents. Keep in mind, we're not big fans of the Iraqi government to start with. We're very unhappy with Prime Minister Maliki. We're very unhappy with the way they have built their government on a very sectarian basis. They've alienated a lot of people. We don't have great relationships there. We don't have great intelligence there is the other problem. I believe part of the conversation has been, you know, it's not clear that we know enough to know what to bomb where.
And what are we hearing from members of Congress?
Bit of a mix, really. Mm-hmm. You know, there is some sort of a hawkish wing, I guess you would say, you know, the McCains and the Lindsey Graham, you know, who will say, well, we should be definitely be bombing and we should, you know, help Iraq fight these guys off. Keep in mind, at one point, McCain was saying, it would be fine with me if we were in Iraq for 100 years. I think his point was basically that an American presence is going to be necessary to stabilize that country for a long time. I think that's actually a minority view now. Now the question is, can you be a little bit at war? You know, can you send in drones? Can you send in air power without sending Americans into harm's way and getting us back engaged in a war that I think the American people clearly have said they wanted no part of, or they want no part of now. They've just worn out on it. There's not a lot of good options here.
You mentioned a couple of the senators who have been characterized as hawks on this issue and in the past. How about the more libertarian wing of the Republican Party, people like Senator Rand Paul, who's been accused at least of having an isolationist foreign policy? Have we heard from them on this?
No. And that's where you get into this really interesting question for folks like, you know, Rand Paul and some of the other Tea Party members who really do believe, for philosophical reasons, in a much more limited extension of U.S. power, that we should not be getting involved in conflicts all over the world. This one is a really tough challenge. I mean, you've got a group of the most bloodthirsty people, frankly. If you've seen any of the pictures that have been published of, you know, massacres being carried out by this jihadi group, who apparently is sufficiently unhinged that even al-Qaeda didn't really want much to do with them. But they're also in a position now to conquer significant parts of northern Iraq into Syria, and it becomes possibly a terrorist factory that we would have to respond to for years. So what do you do? I mean, this is exactly why I don't want to be president of the United States, and I think a lot of people don't, because there's no real good answers.
Members from both parties criticized the Obama administration for not informing them about the prisoner exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl captured in Afghanistan. Is today's meeting maybe a way to mend fences and say, hey, I am going to talk to you guys?
Well, you know, that's possible. I think the better way to look at it is if you remember how Obama handled Syria, is that he basically announced that we were about ready to bomb Syria for the use of chemical weapons. And then, after sort of a week of dissatisfaction from Congress, he pulled back and said, okay, well, let's ask Congress's permission and get them involved. And my suspicion is that this is more like that kind of situation where Obama wants to be able to say that he had congressional approval before he launched any strike, that he had briefed Congress, he had kept them informed in the loop, and that there was some level of agreement that this was an important thing to do.
Well, he's meeting with congressional leadership. One of those leaders is changing after his primary loss. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said he's stepping down as House Majority Leader. Looked like this could be an epic battle, establishment Republican Party, Tea Party, trying to get this key leadership spot. And where are we at now?
Well, at the moment, the majority leader spot, I think, is a pretty easy deal. There's the current number three in the Republican leadership, a guy named Kevin McCarthy from California, is very likely to be able to move into that seat without a great deal of trouble. There's mm-hmm. one candidate against him, a kind of Tea Party guy from Colorado named Raul Labrador, who doesn't really have the resources to compete with the majority whip, whose job is, after all, counting votes. So when he wants to get voted up to the next job, he probably has the votes to do it. The more interesting possibility is what's going to happen after the elections in November. I mean, I think for the Tea Party groups, they feel like this race, these elections in the next, you know, tomorrow, are really just placeholders. After the elections in November, a whole new crop comes in, and you get a chance to have what is essentially a referendum on the entire Republican leadership, including the Speaker of the House. I am almost certain there will be somebody who wants to challenge John Boehner for his seat as Speaker. Whether they'll win or not is a different question, but that's when they're going to want to make their stand. I don't think they're going to make a big splash this week.
And they're hoping that they will control both houses. Republicans are at that point, so a leadership position is maybe a bigger deal then.
Right, and you know, for all of these senior positions, keep in mind, I mean, the majority leader is assumed to be the next in line for the speakership if the speaker leaves for whatever reason. There has been some rumors over time that John Boehner might be ready to leave because, frankly, being the speaker of this house has been so annoying. But we'll see. I mean, it depends partly, exactly as you said, on what the outcome of the elections are. If the Republicans strengthen the majority in their House and take the Senate, these positions become really leading the country.
Well, whoever wins these votes within Congress may not get a lot of love from the rest of the country. A new Gallup poll out earlier this week showing Congress again dipping lower, lowest approval rating in a midterm election year in at least four decades, 16% approval of Congress.
Right, right. But keep in mind that the president's approval ratings are also going down. Mm. So it's not clear which party benefits from that. I think the thing that is clear, and to some degree, I think the Eric Cantor election showed that there's just a real dismay with Washington in general. If you've had anything to do with Washington, you are seen in a very harsh light. But since there are both Democrats and Republican incumbents running for re-election, it's hard to know how that sorts out in November, which ones suffer worst. I think clearly for the Democrats, they are at risk in more places, in the Senate particularly, so maybe that's worse news for them.
So something that I gather is being talked about a lot in Washington today and something members of Congress have talked about was Washington's National Football League team lost
yes,
the trademark over its name. The Trademark Commission said it's disparaging to Native Americans. I didn't know you could withdraw a trademark. What does that mean? What's the buzz around Washington on this?
Well, I mean, you know, the first version of the buzz is that there are people who have said for years that the Washington Redskins is an offensive name for a football team and it should be changed. And the current owner of the team, Dan Snyder, is a litigious and unpleasant person most of the time. So he's never been really willing to talk about this much. Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, went to the floor this morning after this trademark case and said, basically, the writing is on the wall. The name is going to change. Let's start deciding the new name. So, of course, you know, every news organization and every Twitter feed and everything else is talking about what do you want to call them? The Washington Red Tapes or something. But it's hard to know. I mean, the team has already said they're going to challenge this. The last time this happened in the 1980s, similar ruling from a similar panel at the U.S. Patent Office, it was ultimately overturned by a judge. So, you know, still a long road to go, but it's hard to imagine in modern times that you could carry on with a name like this much longer, but who knows?
In other congressional sports news, I guess there's a big baseball, softball game going on out there?
The big softball game, yeah. There's an annual women's congressional softball game as a fundraiser for breast cancer. And it's become a great event. It's women member of Congress playing softball against women reporters who cover Congress. And it's at this community center on Capitol Hill, and it's a great event. I mean, Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner will probably both show up and cheer on their team. There's all kinds of trash talk going on online, and the women members of Congress and the women reporters sort of, oh yeah, watch out, buddy, I'm going to get you at third base. It's hilarious, and it's a great game, and it's a great cause, and everyone shows up, and I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the captain of the women's team, and if you follow her Twitter feed at all, you'll see Democratic politics salted nicely with softball. So, that'll be 7 o'clock tonight, assuming we don't get rained out by the weather.
Sounds like a fun break from a lot of what else goes on in Congress. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Rob. You guys be well.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to take us behind the scenes and out of left field in Congress.